It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
There's been a lot of conversation about what generations are choosing to eat, what gets them excited, how they feel about food. Well, I'm really happy to have with me today the author of a book that looks just exactly at that issue. She's the author of a book called Taste of Generation Yum. I'm going to have her explain that because we've talked about millennials, and we talk about boomers, and I don't talk about yum. But Eve Thoreau-Paul is the person to do that, and she has had a journey that's really one I envy, that she's gone to other people that have opinions, that have written books. She's gotten their views on this issue, and from that, she's put a book together, and she speaks about it, and she's got a perspective on what the new generations are wanting. And I'm just really delighted to have Eve Thoreau-Paul on Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thanks for having me.
Oh, you know, it's great. So tell me about this journey you've been on, because you've decided you were going to tackle an issue and get to the bottom of a story here. How did that happen?
Yes. So I am myself a millennial. I was born in 1987, and I had no interest in food until after college. And suddenly I found myself living in D.C., cooking elaborate meals most of the time just for myself, living on $30,000, mm-hmm. and so attempting to make means while splurging on cooking classes or really amazing truffle cheese. And then I moved to New York City to get my graduate degree, and it was food culture amplified, especially for young people. So I was getting my degree in creative nonfiction writing. Everyone was pulling out their phones to tell me where they had gone to dinner the night before, showing me pictures of recipes that they'd tried. People were judging one another based on their food choices, saying, oh my gosh, you haven't been to Momofuku, what's wrong with you? Or you haven't tried a kale salad, what's wrong with you? And it struck me as bizarre. And I started to question my own behavior, my own priorities, in that, again, I hadn't cared about food at all, and suddenly I'm living in this super expensive city, and I am spending my money on underground dinners instead of taxi rides or laundry. And I was also examining why this was happening on a larger scale among those around me, especially as we were a recession-dented generation. And I began to understand that this recession-dented generation was spending its discretionary income on an ephemeral good, which was food. And I found this very, very confusing. And so started to ask the question, why is this happening? And once I started to research what the answer was, it turned out to be far more complex than I'd anticipated. And 7 years later, I'm still looking into it.
Well, I want to jump in on a couple of things that I've heard you say now, too, and that is, I mean, certainly you're coming from a position that you're a millennial yourself, and you're admitting that you didn't have a lot of money, which is all a drawback being in New York, but the priority that millennials in particular, and I'm going to ask you to expand on that, because it's not necessarily just by a factor of their age that people are looking at eating a certain way. But I believe, if I understood you right, you were saying that millennials spend more a year on coffee than they do on saving for retirement. Is that true?
41% of millennials every year, according to SurveyMonkey, are spending more on coffee than they put away in savings. And this generation is, by and large, spending more money on food than any other generation. So they're spending more than baby boomers, they're spending more than Gen X. And what I found most intriguing about this is that that pattern has never happened in modern history. So young people traditionally have spent their discretionary income on music, on fashion, and on drugs. It has never been on dining out, right? So you maybe were gonna get a slice of pizza with your friends, but that really didn't matter. What mattered was the concert you were going to see, the outfit you were wearing, and what drug you were bringing with you.
Well, now, you've referred to this in your book. You call it Generation Yum. Yeah. How did you come to yum?
So what I began to realize is that over 50% of the millennial generation, which is those born between 1980 and 1996, over 50% of them consider themselves to be foodies. And today, Generation Z, which is a generation younger, so anyone born between 1996 and 2010, they also consider themselves to be foodies. And so to me, together, this consortium of young food-obsessed people is Generation Yum. And the other part of this, which speaks to the point you made earlier, which is that this isn't really just a millennial topic, is through all these years of research, I've found that the main indicator of whether somebody is going to be food obsessed or not is how attached they are to technology. And while these trends are most significantly observed within the millennial generation and Generation Z, because they are the most tech-strapped people, because they have grown up with these technologies and now feel as though they're appendages, there are also people in the Gen X generation and the baby boomer generation who are also on their phones all the time, constantly checking email. They know what's happening with Kim Kardashian, though they wish they didn't. And those those folks who are tech-strapped and key players in the digital age, they are showing momentum towards a desire for the analog, for communitarian experiences, for a sense of control in their lives, and many people are finding that through food culture.
So you don't necessarily have to be 35 and younger,
right,
to be in what you've just described.
Right.
I'm glad I can still qualify. I'm going to give you an application because I feel like I'm strapped to technology and not doing so well. But I know a lot of people like that. So, So this is what I think is your unique take on this. I've seen a lot of people offer theories of what's going on and what millennials want to eat, but I think that you're the one that really registered with me, the making this technology connection. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense, maybe. I mean, when you can't go through a day without being strapped to technology, that mm-hmm. you want to be a foodie. And does this extend to why farmers markets are so popular and
Absolutely.
CSAs?
Without a question. So really what I focus on today, which is going to be the topic of the new book that I'm writing, is the ways in which the digital age, so the world post-iPhone, is disrupting many of our core human needs. So if you think about the fact that the iPhone came out in 2007,
hard to believe.
Shocking, yeah. Right? It's shocking to think how much our human existence has changed with the development of that one device, the way that we communicate with one another, the way we evaluate our own self-worth, on social media, the lack of eye-to-eye conversation, the longer working hours. I can go on and on, right? Fake news, whatever it's going to be.
Oh, I was going to add that they kind of invented podcasts, too.
Right, there you go.
That's a good thing.
Yes, that's a good... No. The internet is... It all depends on how you use it.
Sure.
Right? In many ways, we're more connected than we ever have been. And people have access to information that they never had before. There's plenty of positives to it, but it has drastically changed the way that we live our lives, and we as Homo sapiens haven't changed really in the last 50,000 mm-hmm. years. Mm-hmm. So what I have become super interested in lately is how is the digital age disrupting many of the core needs that we have as Homo sapiens, and what are people doing to cope? And what I'm finding over and over and over again is that people are returning to things that are pretty innate to human nature, and one of those things is food. So let's take the farmer's market example. Well, it turns out that people want to know their food purveyors because for all of human existence, we have grown our own food mm-hmm. or we have sourced it from the farmer down the street or the baker up the block or whatever it was going to be. We bought fabric from someone who was coming through town and then we sewed our clothes ourselves, right? But we always knew when it came to things that we were ingesting, we knew what the source was. Mm-hmm. You knew the story behind it. So right now I'm looking into... if anyone who listens to the podcast happens to have information on this, I'm looking into any studies in psychology that can prove that food is more flavorful to people, that people enjoy food more when they know the source of it. I found one study right now that's showing that. I'm looking for more examples. But to me, it seems it would be natural through evolution that human beings would enjoy food more when it's from a trusted source.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's an interesting paradox to look at some stage, too, because there always has been also an appreciation for some of the exotic. I mean, some things that were coming from the jungles of Brazil or some of the spices that we sent people around the world looking for and 400 years ago or something something like that. Yeah. So there's been a spot for the exotic and a spot for what they could just grow locally as well.
Right. Well, I mean, that's also part of human evolution, right? We're curious beings.
Sure.
Right? We're always on the hunt for something new. And today you're seeing a desire for unique exotic ingredients, in part because people want new experiences. They want unique experiences they can tell other people about. There's also the fact that because of the internet, people are more aware of other cultures.
Well, and I'm wondering, too, with your premise, if somebody has got a really big debt with school loans, for example, and they're getting started in their career and they're not sure how they're going to make ends meet and they're saving, they're not saving much money. They're actually spending more on coffee in a year than they're spending on savings. If this is something that they can say, I had this really great meal at this spot, or I can get these wonderful heirloom tomatoes at this farmer's market, and it's taking the place of maybe a vacation in Tuscany.
Right. That is a huge part of this. I mean, you're talking about a generation that is going to be behind generations before it in terms of economics and income for decades, right? It's going to take a very long time for this generation to catch up, if we ever do. And we're also battling student loan debt and a number of other issues. And a lot of young people around the world, I should say, this is happening in Korea, it's happening in Australia. A lot of young people are saying, I can barely pay rent. How am I ever going to buy a house? It's not going to happen. So why don't we put that out of the picture? And instead, I'm going to really enjoy this amazing Korean barbecue restaurant with my friends. Where we're going to drink a lot of soju and have fun and sing karaoke, right? It's about cultivating joy in your life and how people think about doing that today versus how they've done it in the past.
So, Eve, when you get this hypothesis and you've got this idea, did you find it after lots of conversations? I mean, for example, the book that we refer to here, you entered kind of the interview, the who's who of the food movement from Bittman and Michael Pollan and Marion Nestle. And man, you could just name drop all of them because those were in your book. Did they help form this opinion or did they confirm it after you ran it up the flagpole?
No, I mean, a little bit of both. So I started off on this project really knowing nothing and having no assumptions. So step one was to see whether this was actually a millennial thing. So I then had to discovered all this data that proved that millennials were in fact spending more money. The second question was, has this ever happened before in history? So then I had to speak to some culinary historians, read a lot of Warren Bobrow's books.
Who?
Warren Bobrow.
Oh, I don't know him.
He's an academic, or the United States of Arugula I read, and there's a number of different books. But really looking at, I found out this really hasn't happened before. Okay, so then I had something that was unique, right? And then I interviewed millennials. Step one was interviewing millennials. So spending time with young people, interviewing them, shadowing them, living with some of them, attending work with them, and developing my theories. And then I was able to, through serendipity in large part, end up in situations where I could actually meet a lot of these individuals in person and could approach them. So I met Mark Bittman in Vermont at a food event and just approached him and said, listen, this is my theory. What do you think of it? Mm-hmm. And at first he said, I don't agree. He said, I have one daughter in her 20s, one daughter in her 30s, one's an Xer, one's Gen Y. I don't really see a difference. But I brought up a few of the points of what I had learned in research, and he was intrigued enough to offer me a longer interview. So it kind of, and then once, I met up with him again, he'd given it more thought and was like, well, yeah, I guess the internet has really changed things, right? So then we went off from there. But other folks like Anthony Bourdain, who I talked to, brought up the performative side and the branding side of social media that I hadn't thought of previously. So he made the point that he's hyper aware that when he's traveling on his shows and taking pictures of something and posting about it, that it's in essence bragging. Mm-hmm. It's saying, I can't exactly quote what he said because it had a lot of...
I can imagine what he said.
Yeah. but, it was saying, I'm getting to eat this amazing thing while you're at home and sitting in your underwear eating cereal.
Right.
I'm awesome. You should feel jealous. And him making that point made me take a step back and look at my own Instagram feed and say, what was it that I was trying to say with each one of those pictures, especially the ones about food. Why was I taking a picture of that stew or that kale salad or that donut? What was I trying to represent? What was I trying to express to other people? And that side, I hadn't thought of before. So the reason to talk to experts, yes, it's to get validation for your ideas when you think you're right, but I think more importantly, it's for them to give you new ideas that you never would have come up with on your own.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting too, because you mentioned Anthony Bourdain, because when you see his shows, when he's going to a 4-star restaurant, he looks like he's ready to go in for root canal, you know, and he doesn't really look like he's having a good time. But when he's out doing street food and all around right. the world, it seems like he's having a really good time. And the message is that you don't have to spend a ton of money
yeah.
to have something that's authentic and
yeah.
real and just enjoy it.
But at the same time, there's a tribe of people that travel now based on where Anthony Bourdain has mm-hmm. been. You know, I have a cousin where everything that they eat, they say, well, Anthony Bourdain went there. Right? Like, that's how they're choosing where to eat. So it still is voyeuristic
yeah.
in this way that maybe it's not intentional, right? Like, maybe right. that's not how he meant for it to be, and I don't think it's how he meant for it to be, but that is what social media is. It is all branding. It is all about saying, I'm having this amazing experience, and you're not. Therefore, you should try to want this experience. You should want this experience. And if you can replicate it for yourself, then great. You know, another part of what he does that's so intriguing and why people like to be voyeurs is that a lot of his experiences you can't replicate. I'm not going to go to all those places in Istanbul yeah. that he's been to. I want to live vicariously through him. But when people do have the opportunity to replicate what he's had, they want exactly what he's had.
Well, and then some of the other people, you know, like Marion Nestle or Michael Pollan, I mean, they don't make it too fancy either. When they talk about food, mm-hmm. they talk about just eating food, not stuff that's overproduced
right.
and
right.
necessarily real expensive.
Well, and for example, with Marion Nestle, what I went to her for really was the historical context because, mm-hmm. you know, I first started off by asking her how she became a food expert and nutrition, and it was something that had been assigned to her. Well, she was a faculty member. She didn't know anything about food and then had to teach a class on it and had to figure it out. And once she got into it, started to recognize through these years. So again, she's been teaching. She started the food studies program at NYU. And it was really funny because I looked up actually the article that announced this food studies program in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And there's a quote from another expert at the time saying, "This nothing's going to happen with this. No college student is interested in food." And to then talk to her and say, well, what's happened? Why over the last 30 years has food studies become, I think, the number one growing category of graduate school offerings? And, you know, really evaluating how food has become the zeitgeist of this generation and getting her perspective on that was completely unique and original and not something I ever could have found otherwise, right? I mean, she mm-hmm. is who she is and has watched this develop from the very top.
You know, I want to go back to a point you were making earlier about people want to know about the food, but they also want to know where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you see that playing out? I mean, people, the curiosity mm-hmm. of saying, maybe wanting to know the farmer.
Some of it's right, you're into the farmer's market. Some of it is transparent labeling. People just mm-hmm. want to understand what's on the label. There are some companies now where you can scan a barcode and you can actually see where the bar had traveled from. There's a chocolate bar company, Eskenazi, that does this. There's actually a picture of the farmer on mm-hmm. the packaging. But Walmart's doing this right now in China with blockchain so that you can scan a chicken and it'll tell you where the chicken was farmed, where it was transported yeah. from. And in China, it's a big issue because of food safety.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
So it's not necessarily emotional satisfaction, it's physical safety. That part of it is definitely evolving, right? The tracking of it, the beacons, the RFID systems. Another part of this, though, is that people are going to start growing their own food again, right? We're talking about with the rise of the digital, you have a return to the analog, and growing your own food indoors is kind of a perfect marriage of the two because you can't do it without technology, but there's the innate human pleasure of planting a seed and watching it grow and cultivating something for yourself. And with a lot of these sophisticated indoor systems, say you like your tomatoes a little bit sweeter or a little bit firmer or a little bit, maybe you kind of like them a little mushy, maybe you like them to be yellow, you can make your tomato in your growing system. You have full authority over it. You know where it's coming from. And you're making it what you want it to be.
You know, somebody from MIT actually has also said that someday we're going to be matching it up with our own DNA. So you might be able to get the seeds that really totally match with what your system wants. And, you know, right. That's something you could grow yourself as well.
Right. I mean, you could make something that matches the needs of your own microbiome, right? So Now health is being evaluated on the gut level. So just like we have a microbiome, plants also have a microbiome. So this is going to be incredibly sophisticated farming solutions in the future. There's also the possibility, you know, I kind of end up questioning how much control do you really want in something like farming?
Yeah.
I think that there's still the pleasure and joy of it is also in the cultivation and the art. It's not necessarily in making it an algorithm. So I'll be intrigued to see, because in terms of nutritional value, yes, I think it's going to be really important. In terms of your matching it to your DNA, I personally think that we're probably more likely to print out a pill every morning for us to meet those needs. And for food itself, the growing of food, the cultivating of food, to be a conduit to community, a conduit to creativity, a conduit to something tangible, to ownership.
You know, I'm having this strange feeling in talking to you. This is almost like talking to a new mom or a new dad, and they can pull out the pictures of their baby, because in a way, this is kind of like your baby. I mean,
the concept of it?
Yeah, this whole concept, this whole idea. I mean, you found it, and when I hear you talking about it, it's almost like with that sense of pride, like it was a child, that because you've
really
got
confident.
This idea, and you're running a gauntlet with this thing, and you're given the chance of people to pick it apart and say, what's wrong with my theory?
Yeah.
And you're still standing. Nobody's been able to knock the theory down.
Right. I continue to be surprised by that in a certain sense, just because, you know, this is not I am not a professor. Yes, I have an undergraduate degree in psychology. I have a graduate degree, though, in writing. I'm not doing this research in a way that I think the scientific community would necessarily approve of. I mean, it's mostly through interview, and then it's through borrowing other people's data. It's digging into other people's direct sourcing and questioning the way that they're running their studies and collecting it and analyzing it. There is a very clear through line to me.
Mm-hmm.
And through all of these years of pitching these ideas to different companies, what I'm getting more and more often now is validation. So, for example, I just did a project with the Food Network.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me access to pretty much all of their data on everything that they'd studied about millennials and Gen Z. And I also got to see their viewership data. And it all perfectly aligns. Perfectly aligns. So I've been geeking out with the head of data for Scripps Media because their findings are so in, sync. It's completely, their findings are in sync with my own findings. They deepen one another, right? Their data supports my theories. My theory supports their data. Is a story that can be woven together really well. And young people are watching the Food Network in record numbers. I mean, one of their biggest age groups for viewership is ages 2 to 17.
Wow.
It's really remarkable. So
you've taken this information, you've taken this journey, and from it, you've written one book, you've got another book that's on the way. You're speaking and being a consultant to people on these various ideas. Where do you go from here? What's next?
I have no idea.
Well, just,
you're the second person to ask me that this weekend or week. I don't know, because I haven't been able to plan any of this up until now. And so
maybe you should stay with that.
Right. And
so
there's
happens.
A part of me that feels as though planning would not be actually in my best interest. Obviously, you need to have a next project. I know what my next project is. I know what research I want to be doing next. But I don't really know where this is going to lead. I don't know what projects are going, what other companies are going to be interested in. I don't know if I'm going to want to turn this concept into a service at some point, a company at some point. So
well, there's a lot of companies. I mean, a lot of them are out there making a living out of helping people plan marketing strategies around demographics.
Right.
And what some people refer to what you're finding is more psychographics than demographics.
Exactly.
So it's not just a question of their age, but this whole package that you've got your finger on.
Right. But at the end of the day, I'm analyzing what is the effect of the digital age on the human experience. And then what I found is that people are coping with a lot of the disruptions to our core human needs by turning to food culture. So it's also the fact that I'm not really just looking at food culture. I'm looking at how human beings are existing in this current environment. And a lot of what I spend my time looking at is how unhappy we are, is how depressed and how anxious and how stressed out and how lonely we are.
Well, how has what you learned affected your life? I mean, I know it affects how it's keeping you busy, but I mean, you've gotten this enlightenment that you've enlightened yourself in this process, let alone what you're sharing with everybody else. So how has it changed you?
Yeah. So I garden.
Good.
I actually harvested a few tomatoes before I flew out here to California, which is both exciting and terrifying at the same time, that the climate will allow me to do that. But so I garden. My husband and I, we decided to source our produce from local farmers. We give our money to a CSA, so once a week a farm distributor comes in and hands us our bag of fresh produce, and we get kind of really whatever's in season. We don't really eat a lot of meat. We're only eating what the local butcher can provide us. We can go talk to the butcher, ask how things should be used. And I think the biggest thing that we've done is we have eliminated phones from the bedroom. So I think that we are far more aware of the addictive tendencies of being online. My husband's a school teacher. It's less applicable in his life because he's on his feet all day talking to 8-year-olds. But for me, I'm spending my whole day online for the most part. And it's draining. It makes me very afraid of the world. It fills me with anxiety. I also find that sometimes I'm, you know, sifting through Instagram and literally don't remember what the last photo was that I looked at. It's really become a fully addictive, mindless behavior. And so doing this research, recognizing what that's doing to my emotional stability, has convinced me to let go of a lot of it. And I think that I even need to let go of even more. But keeping phones outside of the bedroom is a huge thing. I mean, once we did that, we realized that we were talking to each other more. We were reading more. It was getting back to like, oh, wait, this is what I would rather be spending my time on.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what about cooking? Do you cook yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I cook every night that I can. Every once in a while, obviously, the work runs over into dinner and you have to order in or sometimes go out, which is rare, but cooking for me is my zen time. It is the indication that my work day is done. It is the indication that it's time to shut down the computer and put away my phone. It's a time to be completely creative. So again, we source our vegetables from local farmers. We're getting whatever's in season. So I haven't necessarily planned out meals because I don't need to do the grocery shopping. It's given to me. So every night it's going and looking in the fridge and saying kind of like, what can I paint tonight with these colors?
Oh, that's such a great way of putting it. Now, so when was the last time you really were impressed with your painting? I mean, your cooking, that you had a meal and it all clicked and you had what you pulled stuff out of the refrigerator and opened some cans or whatever and mixed things together. And you thought, I feel good. I've reached my zen state.
So I made a very vegetable full bolognese the other night with spaghetti squash. So it wasn't pot, like instead of pasta we had beautiful spaghetti squash, which I cooked. We had a package of ground beef from the local butcher, and then we had tons of vegetables. We had escarole, we had carrots, we had onions,
tomato sauce.
We had tomato sauce. That was the only thing that was out of season. But
it's
then I had fresh,
because it's preserved.
I'm a huge fan of canned tomatoes. I use them all the time. But fresh rosemary, fresh thyme. And I let it simmer for 4 hours. And it just took on this unctuous flavor that was so soothing and so comforting. And, you know, I'd earlier in the day been looking at the fridge. I'm like, what the hell am I going to do with escarole? Like, what am I going to turn this into? We were going out of town. I had to use up everything in the fridge, and it turned into this beautiful harmony that, you know, I just remember my husband looking up after a first bite and he was like, this is amazing.
Well, I tell you what, it's a delight having this conversation with you. I got two questions for you.
Yep.
One, I guess one would be, after you've gone on this journey, you're in the middle of the journey yourself, what makes you the most optimistic about the next several years?
Well, first of all, I'm a highly anxious person and a highly cynical person. So I am definitely one of those doom and gloom people. But the thing that gives me immense hope is that in all of this chaos, people are paying attention to food. They're using food as a way to get together with people in person.
Mm-hmm.
The time when you're least likely to be on your phone is when you're eating. That's not, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that everyone puts down their phone when they eat, but statistically it's the when you're least likely to be on your phone. People are using food as ways to reconnect with farmers, with agriculture. Mm-hmm. They're using food to educate themselves about the climate. And I think most importantly, they're using food to cultivate a sense of meaning in their lives by feeding other people, by growing things, by creating something beautiful that's tangible and is nourishing others. And when you think about the fact that in all of this chaos, in the rise of technology and everyone's talking about disruption, what is it that people are spending their time and money on? It's eating really great food and creating moments to eat together. And I think that's very uplifting.
That's tremendous. And I suppose if people would like to spend some time reading a book, they could read a book you've written. Do you have a website?
I have a website. You can go to eveturopaul.com, and it's Turo with one R, T-U-R-O-W.
And I suspect they can find your book online at the
yep.
company that Whole Foods is associated with.
Yes, exactly. You can. You can download the ebook there. If you want to buy it in print, there is a link on my website to a local publisher in New York that will print it and send it to you.
Ah, that's wonderful. Well, Eve Turow Paul, thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.